morning, everyone. We are going to finish the story, and then we'll do a little review. So if you have this from last week and the week before, it's the same one, by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. We're going to...
Oh, it's from before?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have any other extras. Okay, so let's set the scene. We spent the better part of our discussion last week going into the different worldviews of the personalities that we're looking at in the story: Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, what they all mean, how we're supposed to relate to their ideas. Whose opinion is sort of the opinion that carries the day, makes the most sense for the generation, for our generation. And that was a summary of what we did last week. So let's focus today on Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. What happened to him and why is it such an important story to look at and to analyze? This is like the longest Agadah that we've studied together, but we'll hopefully finish up today. So let's jump in. I'm on the second page, okay? So the second side, which is the part of the story where Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, runs away. First, he runs away to the Beit Midrash, and then it's not safe in the Beit Midrash after a certain amount of time. And he subsequently runs away to a cave with his son, and he spends, as we know, 12 years there studying, praying, meditating, and getting to a very high and lofty spiritual place. And it's during this time, as we mentioned, according to many, many sources, he's writing deep secrets of the Torah, the Zohar, mystical teachings, other parts of his writing, perhaps. And on the first time we read this part of the story, the first session, which was weeks ago, we spoke about how in order for a person to get into a spiritual state, and I could probably, anybody here who's ever had a very intense tefillah experience or a very intense meditation experience, whether it's real meditation, meaning you did some sort of hypnotic, state, or you just got into some place, some feeling, some emotional state, psychological state. You were, in a certain place in nature, perhaps, or a certain experience in your life, whatever and wherever it happened. We all know that you can't just jump into such an experience. There has to be somewhat of a preparation, and for sure, for Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai to be able to be in the cave and accomplish what he accomplished in the cave, he had to actually remove himself or disengage himself from the world. Now there is a comment in the story, which we sort of went through pretty quickly the first time, and I just want to start with that. And that's the comment about the wife of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Wife of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is helping him while he's in the Beit Midrash. She's bringing him food. Perhaps she's giving him news of what's going on in the outside world. And at a certain point, Rabbi Shimon realizes that he can't stay in the Beit Midrash anymore. It's not a safe place. Why is it not safe? He's worried that if his wife is questioned, interrogated by the Roman officials, she may not be able to keep the secret, keep the quiet, keep the confidentiality, and might expose the location of Shimon Bar Yochai, and he'll get caught, and his life will be in danger. Now, he makes his conclusion, and after his conclusion, he goes to the cave. The language that the Gemara uses might come off to, especially people here in this room, as somewhat offensive. The language that the Gemara uses is Nashim Datan Kaloft, which means women are easily impressionable. And therefore, that's the top line on the second page, and therefore there's room for concern lest the authorities torture her and she reveal our whereabouts. Now, it's hard for me to imagine that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was saying something negative about his wife. What does this mean? What is the meaning of this idea? And again, this is one interpretation, one commentary, but it's quoted in a lot of places. And the idea of kal dat, which is, here they're translating it as easily impressionable. What it really means
is when God created Adam and Chava, when he created, you know, the first male and female,
there were certain emphasis, things, traits, behaviors that were emphasized more in women, less emphasized in men, more in men, and less in women. And there's complementary traits between them, and that's usually, what creates a good match in life between a man and a woman. So this idea of kal dat, what it means, the way it's understood by many commentaries, is that the regesh, when we talk about regesh, we're talking about the emotional side of a person, is broad, expansive, and it's critical. Meaning, it's what, for women, it's what, in many ways, carries the day in so much of what goes on a day-to-day basis. By men, okay, it's almost like the opposite direction, almost the opposite emphasis. I'll give you an example of this from Tanakh. We know that Sarah and Abraham were both prophets. But who is the greater of the two in prophecy? We're told that Sarah was a greater prophet. And in that relationship, God told Abraham to listen to his wife. Right? Whatever she says, you should listen to, because she is more in tune, spiritually, emotionally, in tune with what needs to happen, what's meant to happen, what has to happen in the house, with the family, with the children, etc. So this line is really meant to highlight the beauty and emphasis in the creation of women versus men. It comes off as something that might sound offensive, but the goal of it is not to be offensive. The goal of it is to say, look at the opportunity that women have in this world versus the opportunity that men have. And that's something that I just wanted to focus on, just so people, you know, if you've never heard this idea before, agree, disagree, it's just one commentary. I think it's something that can help us understand that it wasn't meant to be offensive at all. So let's move forward from there. So they go to the cave. Now, we spoke a little bit on the first time about the cave. What is the cave? What does the cave represent? What does the cave symbolize?
Isolation.
Okay, what else? Is sort of...
Denial
of...
Like, they were in denial that just other people would be doing things that weren't...
Okay. Fair. The only thing I would say in response to that is they didn't actually get exposed... They didn't actually get upset at what they were seeing in the world until after they had spent time in the cave. Before they went in the cave, it seemed like they didn't have those... They had sort of their perspective and their worldview about the Romans, what they thought about the outside world, but how they reacted to their fellow Jews, you know, going out to work in the fields, we don't get the impression that they had such extreme positions.
Okay. Also, I have a question.
Go ahead.
They didn't see before they went into the cave that people were working their fields and whatever.
They didn't see.
What do you mean they didn't see?
Of course they saw.
Never.
Meaning,
so
we're just...
So when they came out of the cave, why were they... Excited?
Well, what changed, right? What changed? Is that your question? What happened between? Yeah, so let's look. We have to look at that. Cave is a physical space, right? It's isolation. What else does a cave represent? Perhaps. Anybody here ever been in a cave?
Yeah.
What did you feel when you were there?
Feeling alone.
Alone. Okay. Isolated.
Dark.
Okay. What is spiritually? What is the idea of being alone, being isolated?
Connected.
You feel connected, or you feel... You could also feel disconnected, right? You're connected mostly to yourself, maybe mostly if you're interested in connecting with God, then it's a good place to talk to God, because it's quiet, it's isolated, people aren't there to bother you. You're within your own thoughts, within your own world, your inner world. So the cave isn't just a physical location, it's also a spiritual symbol. Let's talk about the next line. What do we have? What is he eating when he's in the cave? What are they eating? What is their menu?
Carobs.
Carobs and water. What are carobs?
close to chocolate now.
What was that?
Isn't it like close to chocolate?
Close to chocolate?
Yeah, they make carrot chips that are vegan.
That's interesting.
But it's like bar, like the bar stuff.
No.
Carobs are fruits. Carobs are fruits. I mean, chocolate also comes from a fruit. But how, does anybody know the nature of how carobs grow?
Is carobs the thing?
They're sort of like an ovalish shape. They look a little bit like...
Like olives.
They look bigger than olives, like more orangey type color. You can look at them. Anyway, there's something unique about the carob. They grow. It's a fruit that's available here in Israel. Haven't had one yet. You can find them in your local shuk. What do we know about the carob tree? You found a picture.
It looks like a flat banana.
Yeah.
Oh, what?
I think that's the outside. So I think it's on the inside.
That's what I was talking about. The bark is here.
Yeah, I guess you could compare it to that. It takes a very long time for carobs to grow. Very long time. We're talking about years. Okay. There's a story. Maybe we'll do this Agadah in a few weeks. The story of Choni HaMa'agel, who went to sleep for 70 years. And then there was a carob tree. It took 70 years for the tree to grow. That entire time. Until you could benefit from the fruit that was growing on it. So, I don't know, 70 years is the actual number, or just, you know, sort of a saying was a long time. We can analyze that maybe at a different point. But it takes a long time for carobs to grow. So, yes, carobs, number one, are very satiating. So even if you eat just a few of them, you'll feel full, which is helpful because he didn't have a lot of other options. So water and carobs, that was sort of the menu. But carobs represent something else. Since what I said before about the length of time that it takes to actually benefit from such a food, this represents what we call dat miyushevet. Patience or a settled mind, not being impulsive, right? Not having a behavior of impulsivity, and that's necessary for Rabbi Shimon to develop the system of Torah, the system of Jewish thought that he was developing at that time. What do you think about this idea that he would pray in the middle of the day? Have anybody here ever heard of the concept that when you're studying Torah, you don't have to do anything else? Or like this idea of osik b'mitzvah, patur min mitzvah. If you're involved in one mitzvah in a very intensive kind of way, you don't have to stop and do other things. Because there are certain mitzvot that keep it of the aim, you might have to stop to keep it of the aim, or you might have to stop to, I don't know, bury a dead body if they don't have, you know, people to do such things. Certain things you might have to stop for. But generally, studying Torah is a very high value. And if you're in the middle of studying Torah, you don't have to stop to go and do something else. Even prayer, which is interesting, except maybe for Shema. But especially for a person or personality where Torah is their livelihood. When I say livelihood, I don't mean that's their what they get the salary for, but that's their life. Their life is consumed by Torah study. Therefore, if their life is consumed by Torah study, they don't really need to be praying. So one commentary here is, you know, their Torah study was also like a form of prayer, whatever that means. But there's something else here. Because when you're studying Torah, especially the type of Torah that they were studying, you can get yourself into a place where you're very disconnected from the world. I don't know if anybody here has ever had such an experience. Where you're studying and you're having a really inspiring, listening to a really inspiring talk, shiur, you know, having a great discussion with somebody, and almost like, show of hands if you've ever experienced this, you like leave the world in a way, or like leave reality. Just like you're feeling very spiritual, very, very connected, and then all of a sudden, like, you know, the talk ends, the discussion ends, the learning chavruta ends, and you're sort of like, how do I come back to the world? How do I come back to my reality? People with me on this concept? You can have such an experience. So imagine Rav Shimon bar Yochai, he's isolated. He's having this super spiritual moment, years, right? And he's completely disconnected from the world, from reality. And all of a sudden, he has to go back into the world. So what does tefillah do? What does tefillah do? It grounds a person. Because tefillah is all about, you know, connecting the spiritual world with the world that we live in. Especially Shemona Esrei, if we ask for. Those are physical things. Rifa'enu, Tachonei, Barechaleinu, Parnasa, health. All these things, those are physical things. Therefore, tefillah is a way to stay connected to reality even when you're totally disconnected from reality. So tefillah is very crucial for Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai while he's in the cave. Because it's a reminder that even though you're right now focused on something very spiritual, something very lofty, you're going to have a constant reminder that one day you're going to leave this cave, and one day you're going to need to go out into the world and to correct something, and to fix something, and to make a tikkun of sorts, a fix of some sort. And that seems to be the symbol here. 12 years? Is that a random number? Anybody want to take a thought, a guess? Why 12? Number 12? As we've seen in all the Agadah. Sometimes, you know, sometimes the symbols have less meaning or represent something. But here, there's a lot of symbols here in the story, as you've seen. So the 12 years, some suggest the following idea. We know 6 days of the week, or 6 years of the Shemitah cycle, and the seventh year is Shemitah. And the number six usually represents like the physical part of the world, the days of the week. Or the years of Shemitah, where we're allowed to work our fields, and the seventh year is like Shabbat. The seventh day of the week, the seventh year of the cycle, it's like a Shabbat. Where we don't work, where we don't work the land, where we don't create, etc. So the 12 is two cycles of six. Some understand to mean, sort of the Torah that's a revealed Torah, which you might call studying, you know, Pshat, studying the simple understanding of text. And the second 6 years is getting to the higher level of interpretation. Why not seven? Why not 14 years? Some explain that Rabbi Shimon was in such a madriga, such a level, such a spiritual level, that the whole time it was like he didn't need a seventh year. The entire first six and second six were entirely like he was having a Shemitah or a Shabbat the whole time. And Eliyahu HaNavi, this is a very curious part of the story, the end of that paragraph at the top. What is Eliyahu HaNavi's role here? Why does he come in? What is his... Kind of random, right? I mean, Eliyahu HaNavi, we would all probably say, he usually comes in at a random time. Like, if he's not alive, he's coming back as some, spirit or dressed up person, old man with a cane, standing at the entrance of the cave. Who is Eliyahu HaNavi? Eliyahu HaNavi was a prophet, of course. And Eliyahu HaNavi is a personality who represents Tikkun in this world. He was a person who could have stayed in Yerushalayim during his lifetime. For those who studied the stories of Eliyahu HaNavi, Sefer Melachim, he could have stayed in Yerushalayim. He could have, you know, been with the group of spiritual prophets, hanging out, working on himself, getting to a higher level. But what did he do instead? He went out into the world to try to fix society, to try to, you know, speak truth to power, to the king who was corrupt, Ahab at the time, Izebel. It's a very corrupt time in history. And Eliyahu HaNavi didn't sit on the sidelines. He was a person who went out and got active. So he's standing at the entrance of the cave, and he represents sort of that world, you know, of tikkun, that message of there's things to fix in this world. And he stands at the entrance. What does the entrance of the cave represent? It's also very symbolic. It's a very symbolic point. The entrance of the cave represents the entrance to your house, the entrance to any place, which is an inner world, the inside world, the outside world, right? The border line between what's outside the cave, which is the whole world, and inside the cave, which is this place of isolation and spirituality and you know, full attention on yourself and on your personal growth. Now he stands at the entrance and he says, who's going to tell Bar Yochai that the emperor died and his decree has been abrogated? It's very interesting. He doesn't say leave the cave. What does he say? doesn't say it's time to leave the cave. It's time to, you know, you had a nice vacation, time to get back to work. It doesn't say that. What is his line? What is he expecting? If you're Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and you hear this, so now what? He's expecting him to make the decision on his own. Right? He wants him to decide that the time has actually come for him to rejoin the world. So let's move to the middle paragraph. So they come out of the cave, they see people plowing and sowing. So here Michal's this part of the story. Rav Shimon says, these people, what are they doing? They're abandoning eternal life and they're engaging in temporary life. Right? This world. Instead of focusing on Olam Haba, they're focusing on Olam Hazeh. Instead of focusing on Torah and spirituality, they're focusing on money and land and agriculture. And these are things they shouldn't be involved in. Now, what is so wrong with what they're doing? What is so wrong with what they're doing? So if you're Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, you just spend 12 years in a very spiritual place. Not the cave. Cave isn't necessarily a spiritual place, but in a state of being. And now, he comes out into the world. So, what is a defining... for him, why is he so bothered with what he sees? Why is he so bothered with what he sees? Let people do what they want. Leave people alone. Right? He starts destroying everything. So, what do you think? What do people here have to say on this? Why can't he just let people be? Why does he get so upset? Why is he so bothered with what he sees? Suggestions? Everybody's tired this morning? Too much thinking?
Yeah, exactly.
Working too hard? It appears that Rabbi Shimon saw the cave as what we would call like a Gan Eden. It's like paradise. How could you think of a world that's better than the world that Rabbi Shimon had just been in? Constant connection to God. I feel fine. I have food. I have my basic things. I have what I need. Where could there be better? Why would anybody want to be outside of Gan Eden? That's basically, he's looking at the world. He says, the cave was Gan Eden. The cave was paradise. I got to learn Torah all day. I got to be connecting with God. I didn't have to worry about finances. I didn't have to worry about going to university. I didn't have to worry about this school, that school. I didn't have to worry about social. I didn't have to worry about anything. Life was just great. I was there with my son. We could learn. We could connect. We could meditate. We could pray. Why would anybody want to be outside of that world? And now you're like hearing it. You're like, the pressures of the world. Why would... Now, some people would say, okay, that's just like escaping reality. Rabbi Shimon would say, no, that's the ideal. When Adam and Chava sinned, that was the less ideal. The Gan Eden world was where they were supposed to live forever. So Rabbi Shimon says, that's the world that I was just in. Why would anybody want to be outside of that? It's pretty strong. Right? It's pretty strong. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was also the person who said, in a different place, Masechet Brachot, where they had a debate. You should remember this. But they had a debate. Remember? Last year, we spoke about this. There was a debate about how much time should a person devote to Torah study versus going out to get a job. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai took the position that when the Torah says to Asafta Deganecha, we say it in Shema, Asafta Deganecha, go out and work, go out and collect your grain, go out and work the land, work the field, get a job. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said that's not what it actually means. It doesn't mean you should go out and get a job. What it means is you should study Torah. What do you mean? That's not what it says. It says Asafta Deganecha. No, because there's another pasuk that says V'higita bo yaman v'layla, and say for Yeshua, you should study Torah all day. That should be your entire, you know, life and livelihood. And if you do that, which is the will of God, your finances and your money will come from elsewhere. Somebody else, the non-Jews, will take care of all of the work on your behalf. Well, that's an interesting model. Don't have to go to work. That was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's position. And he lived this position. He lived it and he breathed it. What does it say at the end of the Gemara? Do you remember? Did a lot of people try to actually live that lifestyle? Most people could not. It was a very, very, very small minority. Most people needed, you know, to live a life of balance. a balanced priorities, a balanced work, and Torah study. But this is Rishon Baruch Hai. He lives in Gan Eden. He lives in Gan Eden in his head, and he lives in Gan Eden in the world. Why would anybody want to be outside of that? So what does God say? You came out of the cave to destroy my world? Does God say, go back into the cave? This is interesting. What is the line right after? First he says, did you come out of the world? Then he says, return to the cave. Now they go in the cave and they're there for 12 months. Who decides that they should be there for 12 months? Were they told to go there for 12 months? No, they weren't. What was it?
They were ready to
come. But who decided that they should be there for 12 months? Why didn't they stay for 3 months or 2 weeks or 5 months? They weren't ready, but they made that decision. They made a decision for themselves that they needed that 12-month period, which the Gemara here said, right, it was like the time that a person spends in Gehenna, whatever that means. So there's a certain message here, you know, that they realized after 12 months that was the right amount of time for them to be there. Divine voice emerges and says, emerge from your cave. Now you're ready to go be mitakein. And they need an outside voice to give them this message. So Rabbi Elazar would strike. He still was going strong. And Rabbi Shimon would fix everything that his son destroyed. This was the second time around. Now what does this mean? So I think what this means is to highlight, you know, keep the ideal alive, their ideal, but at the same time, there's a shift. There's a big shift. That's what I want to get to right now and sort of wrap up the whole story here. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai needed to stick to his perspective. And I want to just mention this point. Let me ask this one. This one shouldn't have to think too hard for. He goes back into the cave. Is going back into the cave a punishment or an opportunity? Who here thinks it's a punishment? He's destroying the world. God says, this isn't why you left the cave. Go back in the cave. Go back in the cave. Like, go to your room. You know? Is that a punishment? Or is that a opportunity? And this is really, if you've been zoned in for any of the three sessions on this story, this is the key. This is the key to the whole story.
It feels like he wants to say it's an opportunity.
But why? Why?
To learn more.
To learn. Isn't it, and I'll challenge you, it's fine, maybe it is the answer, isn't it saying to him, I'm asking you to lower your status, to lower your expectation, to lower your standard, to lower your ideal. How can that be an opportunity? Yeah.
I think just like, for example, like you said, when like you're sent to your room, like, it feels like a punishment, but it's also an opportunity to like reflect on what just happened and like, I can like be better going forward. So like, when he's kind of sent to the cave, it's like, he's sent there to like reflect on like what has been done and like how he can be better going forward and like what he can do to change things. And, like, that gives an opportunity to really do that.
Beautiful, beautiful. There are two ways to fix a building or a house that's falling apart. You can either knock it down, destroy it, and start from scratch, which is one way that they do that today. Or you can go to the foundation. They do this all over Israel. You can fix the foundation, strengthen the foundation, and work from the bottom up. Renovate, you know, take down a staircase, redo the apartments, add on a couple floors, make the building beautiful, put new facing on the outside, strengthen the building from the bottom, etc. You accomplish the same thing. You end up with a nice building at the end. One, you're knocking the whole thing down, which sometimes is what needs to be done. Or you can work within what you have and work from the bottom up. So, what's going on here? God says to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the message is, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai believes the only way for the world to get to its place of tikkun is to start from scratch. Flood. Let's destroy the world and build the utopian society that I have in my head. And that's the best way to go about this. God says, go back in the cave. Because if you want to be mitakein the world, you have to work within the reality that exists outside. And that is not a punishment. That's an opportunity. It's a greater challenge. But because it's a greater challenge, it's a greater opportunity. It's much easier to just say, we're going to knock the building down and we're going to rebuild from scratch. It's much easier. You just take a crane, take one of those balls that they have on the cranes, knock the whole thing down, clear away the what was there before, and start from scratch. That's the easiest way to rebuild the world and to rebuild the metaphor, to rebuild society, is to just say, starting from scratch. God says, no. If there's darkness, you have to bring light into darkness. If there's evil, you have to bring good into the evil and change it from the inside. If there are things that you don't like, don't just say, I'm going to walk away and I'm going to pretend like it doesn't exist, or I'm going to try to get rid of it, but try to actually fix things. That is such a powerful message. But Rabbi Shimon didn't have that message initially. So the transformation that goes on here, we'll call it, Chorban. Chorban is utter destruction. Havara, destroying something completely. Versus Tikkun, or Hamtaka. Right? If something is bitter, instead of throwing in the garbage, make it sweet. Put something sweet inside of it. Tikkun. Hashem is not punishing Hashem Baruch Hu. He's pushing Hashem Baruch Hu to work to an even higher ideal. So going into the cave was God's way of saying, and by the way, he says, Amri, this is what Hashem Baruch Hu was saying, we have to leave. Like I said before. I'll give you a reason why I think this is true, and then we'll wrap up the story. There's a saying, I think we say it in Tefillah, La'aretz la'darim aleha barachamim. The way that God lights the world. Think about sunrise. Okay? I'm sure you've all seen beautiful sunrises here in Israel and in other places that you've been. So what does it mean? The way that God brings light into the world is with rachamim. Why is we call the way that God brings light into the world that he does it with mercy? What's the meaning behind that idea? Go ahead. Suggestion.
Maybe like it's like gradual.
Gradual, therefore. If it's gradual, then it's...
You can appreciate every step of it.
And it's, you can appreciate every step, and it doesn't damage us. If the sun would rise in one instant, and we would open our eyes, we would have eye problems. It's true. We know that, right? Any of you have ever had that experience? Just like, you can get dizzy, you can damage your eyesight looking at the sun directly. So that's the explanation here. La'aretz v'la'darim ala barachamim. When God brings light into the world, a little bit at a time, kim akim, a little bit at a time, it's one thing to have and desire the greatest emet. You can be a real idealist. Okay, I'm sure there's people here feel very strongly about certain things, feel very passionate about the views that you hold. And you'll go to every extent to be right and to win the argument, whatever the argument is, whatever you believe, and you'll knock people down in your way, God forbid. Not physically, but just to be right, just to get to that truth that you feel is true. That's a really easy way, easy path to ruin other people's lives. But also to be right. But I think we've said it here before. If you're trying to be right, but your goal is to just be right, you're going to be wrong in the end. Because you're putting somebody else down. By putting somebody else down, you're knocking yourself down. That's not the way that God wants us to act in this world. That's the message of this story. We're here, we have a reality. Are there challenges outside? Yes. So you can just go and say, you know what? I'm just going to destroy everything I see. Every person I see, I'm going to cut them down. You don't deserve to be here because the way you talk, because the way you act, because the way you behave. I don't want to be friends with you. I don't want to be involved in your life. It's very easy to just dismiss people and push them away. It's much harder to help to try to work on people and with people. And work with the reality that's in front of you. And this could apply to our family life, this could apply to our relationships, this could apply to the work, to the school, whatever context you find yourself in, there's going to be darkness. There's going to be things that need work, that need our input. That's the higher level. The higher level is to transform the world, to elevate the world, to bring light into the darkness. And that's exactly what Rabbi Shimon says. What happens in the story? He sees this old man running with the willow branches, right? And he says, why are you holding the willow branch? He says, Kavod Shabbat, Zachor v'Shamor. And he says, now I get it. Now I get it. You can take the things in this world that you might look at as the physical things that, you know, we try to, don't want to be part of, don't want to engage in, and you can actually use them to elevate. You can use them to make life more meaningful, to make our day-to-day existence more beautiful, more whole, more shalem. So let's look how the story ends. Turn to the third and fourth pages here. So the end of the story, we're going to run through this part quickly. The son-in-law of Rabbi Shimon, his name is Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair, he heard that Rabbi Shimon had come out of the cave. He goes to greet him, and they have this very strange exchange in a bathhouse. A bathhouse is basically a place where people went to shower and to get clean. Sort of an inappropriate story to share, but there's a reason why this story is shared. He goes into the bathhouse, and he's tending to his flesh. What does that mean, he's tending to his flesh? If you look in the third page, in the second line in English, he sees that Rabbi Shimon had cracks in the skin of his body. So the meaning of this is that is that Rabbi Shimon was really, really disconnected from the physical world. And what happened to his physical body while he was in this experience is reflecting how focused he was on the spiritual and how neglectful he was, or you know, his environment was, what he was involved in, to his physical body. And there's other examples of this in the Gemara and other places. So Rabbi Shimon needs a tikkun haguf. He needs his physical body to be restored, to reintegrate with the world. You want to impact the world, you have to physically be part of the world. So that's what's going on, this stage of the story. He's starting to reintegrate, to get back to full health, to get back to a place where he's able to physically impact. And then he's crying. His son-in-law is crying, and the tears are falling from his eyes, and he's causing Rabbi Shimon pain. The tears are causing pain. But what's interesting, he was already in pain. But he only felt the pain when somebody else cried, and the tears fell on him. Why is that? He was so out of touch, literally, physically, and literally, out of touch with reality, with the physical world, that he didn't even notice his own pain. He needed somebody from the outside to make him realize physically how much pain he was actually going through. And if you want to integrate back into the world after you've gone through such an intense experience, it has to happen in a very gradual process. I'll give you an example of this. You have a beautiful Shabbat. Didn't you just have an amazing Shabbaton this past weekend?
Yeah.
I only heard about that it was going to be amazing from before, but I hope it was amazing even after. And you're sort of like, you know, on cloud nine, and you meet amazing people, and you just have beautiful tefillot, and beautiful meals, and amazing discussions. And Shabbat can do that if you have a really good one, and it's just like, put that one up for the ages, and store that somewhere away when you're having a bad day. Remember all those people filled with hope and light in their life, and that's good inspiration to carry you forward. How do you come back down to the week? Such a letdown, you know, Shabbat ends and you have to... So what do we do at the end of Shabbat? We slowly let Shabbat leave, right? We have Mariv, we have Havdalah, we have Malava Malka, we have all these things which help us get back into the week. So, you know, some people, Shabbat ends and they turn their phone on and they're right back into regular life. My response to that is you didn't have a real Shabbat. If you are so quick... So you need to reintegrate back into the world, your Shabbat didn't affect you enough. Because if your Shabbat affected you in that way, and you had that experience, you wouldn't want to leave it so quickly. You would need, you know, steps. And that's what's going on with Rav Shimon Baruch Hai over here. And what happens? So, you know, skip to the bottom of the page here. The message of this story, that's what I meant to say, and then we'll read the last lines here. The message of the story is that if you want to impact somebody else, if you want to have an impact on other people's lives, which I would imagine, which is, you know, kind of what you're doing here in this experience here for the year, you want to be a person who can mean something to somebody else, make a difference in somebody else's life. How do you do that? You have to be connected to reality. And that's exactly what's going on. Rabbi Shimon is a person who... is tremendous personality, tremendous Torah scholarship, tremendous ideals, tremendous leader, inspirational. In order for him to be able to impact the world, he needs to be part of the world. So his son-in-law helps him integrate back by showing him from the outside that you can reconnect and be back in society. So what happens? He decides he's going to fix something. Look at the bottom paragraph. Reb Shimon says, since a miracle transpired from him, I will go and repair something for the sake of others in gratitude for God's kindness. Like Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov Avinu was a person who was Ishtam Yoshev Olim. But what did Yaakov do? Even though he was sat in this tents of Torah studying all day, he went and he also was working in society to join the forces of Kodesh and Chol. And the Gemara goes through a whole story where he helps a community identify a location which had previously they had thought was a place that might have a dead body buried there. It was called a Safek. And he goes and he does a whole thing. I'm not going to read through. You can look at it in your own. Read the rest of the story to yourself. He goes and he helps a community which was preventing Kohanim from being able to walk there, which was preventing community to do certain things in that space. And through this tikkun, right, through working within the world, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai manages to create a tikkun in the world. And it's a beautiful end to the story. The end of the story is actually sort of has some tragic ending. He ends up, the guy who told on him in the original part of the story, that was the reason why he went to the cave. Remember the guy who told his family, and then it ended up getting to the Romans. So he actually kills him in the end of the story with his eyes. That's actually how the story ends. You can read that part. But the part that I think we need to focus on is this. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Yehuda, who was the one who said, let's figure out how to integrate our lives, the world around us, figure out how to do Kodesh and Chol, figure out how to be Jewish, be in the world, accept the reality that's around us. That was Rabbi Yehuda's, remember his position in the beginning, and he was the one who was sort of given credit and rescued, and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai had to run away. Does Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in the end of the story actually come out any different than Rabbi Yehuda? He almost comes out exactly the same. Isn't that interesting? In the end of the story, what is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai doing? He's fixing the world. He's joining the world. He's part of reality, and he's doing things to help society. It's not so different than Rabbi Yehuda. There's one major difference. Where are they coming from? Which side, which angle are they coming from? Very, very, very different worlds, very different angles, very different starting points. And that is important, because you might have the same conclusion. At the end of the day, practically on the ground, what are we supposed to be doing? Reb Shimon Bar Yochai has a transformation. That's why this story is important. Because you can see that an individual, he doesn't lose his ideals. And that's why I think this is important. You can be a person who believes something, believe it very strongly. You have a view, political view, a world view, a view of what you should be doing with your life, a view of what everybody around you should be doing with their life. And you could be looking around you saying, why is that person wasting their time on, you know, maybe in the Beit Midrash? I'll give a very local example. You're studying Gemara, one person is studying Tanakh, and another person is reading a book of, I'm not going to say the title, but this book over here. And you might look at that and say, that's not real Torah. They should be studying this. Why are you wasting your time on that? You might really believe that everybody should be studying something specific. So what are you going to do? Go do a book burning? Because all those books are irrelevant and a waste of time. You should be focusing on other things, because you're not actually going to gain anything from that experience. I'm giving a small example, but I think you get the point. Or is there another way to engage that person and actually discover maybe they found true passion for something else, and you can find things that you can learn from them and they can learn from you, and you can gain from each other? That's a fantastic message to walk away with. So many messages from the story, but if there's one that I think is a major takeaway, it's this one. Okay, so we're going to pause here for a second. We just have about 5 minutes. I want to talk about